Well, happy Sabbath, everyone. Nice to be here with you. I guess I'm the creek fill-in for the day. So, I think that's actually the first time my wife and I have been to Indy for services. We know a lot of familiar faces here, but it's nice to be with you on the Sabbath. Hope you've had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I appreciate Mr. McLean's introduction. It's going to tie in with some things I'll discuss today as well. Because if you had to describe, if I asked you, what is God doing with mankind? Or what's his plan? Now, how would you answer that? Maybe take a moment to think, how would you define what God's doing in simple terms? As I think about that, at least in my own mind, my simple kind of quick answer is, God's making a family. Right, we can talk about salvation, different elements, different words that kind of mean the same thing. But to me, the simple answer is God is expanding his family. Much like Mr. McLean talked about how much a family should be a focus of Thanksgiving and so much to be thankful for within those families, God's ultimate plan, the reason he created mankind, was he wanted to expand his family. God's plan, as you see in my title, or maybe my title's not up, I was asked for a title, I didn't know if they posted it or not. My title is simply, God's plan is a family plan. Right? He's making a family, that's his focus. That's the reason he created mankind. That's the reason we're sitting here today. That currently consists of God the Father, God the Son, Jesus Christ. But God wants to expand his family. And so he made mankind to give them a chance and created the 7,000-year plan to say, I want to expand my family. He speaks about this as we kind of jump into this over in the book of Romans. Go with me to Romans chapter 8. We'll begin in verse 14. Romans 8 and verse 14. Here in Romans 8, 14, the Apostle Paul writes, "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God." He says, if you're led by God's Spirit, you're classified as a child of his. You're becoming a part of his family. But he continues, "But you do not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you receive the spirit of adoption by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. If indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together." Notice the focus here Paul makes. Over and over, he states the reality that he says you're becoming a child of God. That spirit that leads us, his spirit that he gives us, is to help us to grow and develop, to become more of his children, to expand what that looks like as we develop his nature and his way of life in us. It uses that term, even a spirit of adoption, which isn't really a great translation. See, at Paul's time when he wrote this, when children are born into a family, they didn't instantly become children in the sense that we think about it today. When someone is born into the family, they're more a servant initially. The children born didn't have full rights as children of that family. But at some point, if the parents say, well, I like this kid enough, you get to actually become my full-fledged son. This word really often translated sonship to say, you get full rights, which is why the next thing he talks about is that you're joint heirs with Christ. He says you get to be on the same level, same plane, that same set of rights that the full son, Jesus Christ, gets. God's bringing you to that level. Not adopted kids that are second tier. He says no, full-fledged children of God is the promise. And this thought continues in verse 18. He says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation." So the whole creation has an expectation. And he says it's this, that awaits for the revealing of the sons of God. So the whole purpose of the creation, its expectation, its desire, all it's been made for, is for the revealing of the sons or children of God. So that's the epitome, that's the climax of the whole plan, is when God gets to expand his family. So that's what it's all about. His plan is a family plan. And he reveals some pretty profound things within this that is a promise of not, well, if you do well and you get to be in heaven, you become angels, all these things that so many religions, Christian groups believe of what God promises. No, he makes it clear. He says a joint heir with God, a child of God, a joint heir with Jesus Christ to inherit the full benefits of being in the family of God. He said that's the promise. That's the expectation. He says that the whole creation expects and waits for. And it's beyond anything we could comprehend. So much so that he says, and so the sufferings that we go through in this life from time to time can't even be compared when these things become fulfilled in what he promises us. Because to become a full-fledged member of God's family, there's no equivalent, nothing comparable to that reality. So that's the hope and the expectation that he's given us. Sometimes I think we should just pause and reflect on the enormous significance of those promises, of what God is offering us, children of his and his family. And explains the whole plan that God has of creating his family. This father-son relationship, father-daughter relationship that he wants us to have, this family dynamic that he wants to create with all of mankind. And it's amazing, profound, what he offers each of us. And as we think about that, it leads us to two quick realities. One, it shows us what an amazing opportunity God has in store for us, right? The opening to his family to us. But secondly, as we consider this analogy he uses of a father-to-child relationship, it helps us to understand this typology of the family that he's given us now and why it's so important to him as well. That God often gives us physical things to help us understand the spiritual on such a deeper level. And so he says, for you to fully understand what I'm doing on this level, I want you to have families. I want you to have husband and wife relationships and then have children and see the love and the desire and all the benefits that come with it. Because what better way for us to understand his love for us and his plan for us than for us to live it out in this life, just to get a glimpse of the promises that he's offering to us. And within that reality, then, our marriages, our families, our kids should be viewed as so special to us as well. Because it's not even just about the physical family, then. The reason we have to protect those things and honor those things so much is because it's all pointing back to something even greater than our physical families, to God's spiritual family and what he wants us to be doing, what he has in plan for our future forever. Just to get a glimpse of his value and his love for the family, go with me to the book of Malachi for a moment. Malachi chapter 2, verse 11. Malachi 2, verse 11. Malachi, like most of the minor prophets, begins with talking about how bad Israel and Judah have been because they kept messing up. But here in Malachi 2:11, he's talking about a very specific sin, a specific situation that they're doing that is really upsetting God. He has a focus that they're destroying his holy institution of marriage in all these different ways. We won't go into the different details of the different elements that he's upset with. But the overarching theme of this whole section is how much he loves marriage and family and those things. And Judah is just destroying it and paying no mind to it. Notice how he begins in Malachi 2:11. Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. Right, so it begins with strong words, treacherous, an abomination. He says, for Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution, which he loves. He said, they profaned the special thing of mine that I love so much. He has married the daughters of a foreign god. So the first thing he's upset with is that he's taken his holy institution, and Israelites were marrying people of different religions. That's really the heart and core of this, right? He said, you're going to marry these people that worship different gods than I want you to worship of me. They're going to have different idols and all these things. He said, I'm upset because you don't recognize what that's going to do to this relationship that's so special to me. The challenges that's going to bring to you in your life. So that's the first thing he's upset with. And then he drops down. And we'll pick it up again in verse 14. Because he's upset again, he says, and you say, for what reason are you upset? He says, because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? He says, and why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. And verse 16 continues about how much he hates divorce and all the challenges. So this whole section is about all the different elements that can come in and destroy a husband-wife relationship, and by extension, destroy families. Because he says, you know, he wants godly offspring, and that comes from a healthy husband-wife relationship. And so God is railing on Judah here, and he says, my holy institution, this marriage and family dynamic that I want you to have, you're not taking serious. You're not protecting. And again, he wants us to protect it because the value, the blessing that brings on this life now, but even more so because it points to what he's doing in a greater scale for humanity. Now the family is under attack. And God says you have to protect it because it has spiritual ramifications of what all of it is about. Now, I read some studies recently, and one survey showed that the current generation of teens and young adults seek advice from their peers well before they ever get advice from their parents. They said they don't, you know, acknowledge their parents' advice. They go to peers, even as teenagers, and say, I trust my 15-year-old friend and their advice to be more sound than my parents. That kids don't go to their parents for advice anymore as a whole. And if we think about our society as a whole, all of our social kind of movements and societal movements are really doing one major component. They're breaking down the family in different ways. Think about this list of items, whether we're going to talk about divorce, abortions, homosexuality, transgender movement, adultery, pornography, cohabitation, abuse of parents, TV shows that show parents as dumb and ignorant, incapable of being good parents, or parents shown as not needing or deserving respect. Right, our society as a whole, through media, entertainment, society, do all these things that attack the family structure that God has ordained, that God says is the most important thing within the family to show what he is doing. And so what does all this mean? It means that the physical family that God gave us to reflect the deeper spiritual elements of why mankind exists is being destroyed any chance it gets. It's being altered, it's being broken, it's being neglected, and being put down as antiquated and no longer necessary. Right? They say marriage is no longer needed. The family units, that's old, right? That's not needed in our current modern society. God says the opposite. He says it's the bedrock of society because it points to healthy families now, but also because it points to what he has planned for each of us. And so make no mistake, the family is under attack. And the less mankind sees the need and importance of family, the less it needs and understands God's plan of what he's trying to restore them back to. The more mankind sees bad fathers, the less mankind's is going to want to come to their Father in heaven and have a relationship with him. When a child grows up with an abusive father, a broken home, how's that going to affect their view of God's offer to be in his family when all they've had are bad experiences with family and fathers? Right, society is destroying it because it destroys what God is wanting for mankind. And it's going against it in every element of the fact. Even the concept that as father's authority and leadership within the family is diminished or questioned or disrespected, how does that make mankind view the father and his laws and his expectations and the honor and respect that's due to him? Right, so there's a trickle-down effect as the family gets destroyed that it has direct implications to what God is doing with mankind. And because of that, I think the church needs strong families. God has called us to be great fathers, called us to be great mothers, to be leaders in their families to show what a healthy family looks like. Because it's what a great example it is to show mankind what God is doing in his plan. So he's called us to these things. He's called fathers to be leaders of their families, not because men are better, far from it, but because he wants them to be a physical typology of what God is doing as a father who loves his children and as a husband, just in the example of Jesus Christ, who sacrifices and will give his all for his wife, just as we see they do for us. But he wants us to show those things, to represent, and in a sense, role play what God is doing with mankind. Go only to the book of Ephesians for a moment. Ephesians 5, verse 22. So as we think about this today, hopefully it hits in two ways, that we want healthy physical families, right? God wants us to have that. But there's even a greater calling within it, because as we represent that, we're showing the spiritual side of what God is doing. And so we have an obligation to have healthy families, not just because we want strong families, but because it represents what God is doing with mankind. And it foreshadows his plan for the world. Ephesians 5 and verse 22. So God begins here giving some, or Paul here speaking, giving some directives to husbands and wives to show what a healthy relationship looks like. He says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. So he begins by talking to fathers or husbands. He says, you're the leaders, not because you're the best or always make the right decision. Right, he says you're the leader because you represent Jesus Christ in this analogy that represents what God is doing. Like just like he's the head of the church, you're to be the head of your family. With that brings authority, leadership, responsibility. He says, but also with that comes the expectations of sacrifice. To be willing to give all that you are, which means your time, your love, your life, your energy, every element to the deepest parts of your body for your wife. He says, with that responsibility comes these expectations, just as Jesus Christ did for each of us in this room, what he was willing to sacrifice for us. So he says, you have the responsibility to demonstrate Jesus Christ's love on a daily basis to show what that love looks like. This is the example you're supposed to live within this relationship. Not just to be a good husband, but because it points to something so much greater with Jesus Christ and what he did for us. Then he says to women in verse 25. In verse 25, he continues this thought with husbands first. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church. I want to begin in verse 22, and I begin in verse 25. I'm sorry. Hopefully I didn't confuse you there. Verse 22, let's back up a little bit. He says here, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he's the savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. So here he's talking to wives. He talks about how they're submitting to their husbands. And he says, you submit to your husband just as each of us in this room are supposed to submit to Jesus Christ. And so wives have the obligation to represent someone who submits and shows respect just as we do to Jesus Christ on a daily basis, that we trust him and let him lead us. So you have the role of representing the church, God's body of believers who follow Jesus Christ, who trust him, who respect him, and who allow him to lead you, to demonstrate that on a daily basis of what submission looks like. And so what that leads us to is that a husband-wife relationship is a daily reminder to each of us of something much deeper than a physical relationship, but what God is doing on this deep level. And he speaks to that as we drop to verse 30. Verse 30 of Ephesians 5, he says, for we are the members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Then he quotes back to Genesis, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." And notice what he says about this. He says, "This is a great mystery." When the Bible talks about something being a mystery, usually he's saying it's something that's most of the mankind doesn't understand. It's something that's hidden to the majority. Most of mankind, when they get married, they're not seeing the deeper level that is supposed to be a personification of what the church and Jesus Christ relationship. He says, this is a mystery of something so much greater than just a man and a woman having a relationship together. He says, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. How these roles are demonstrated is a daily reminder of our relationship with God. We tell our kids, we want you to follow Jesus Christ. But then if we don't personify what those roles look like, of that relationship between Christ and the church, then how is that going to affect how they view that relationship? If I say, oh, I represent Jesus Christ in this relationship with your mom, then I don't show her love and devotion, I don't sacrifice for her, what does that show our kids of what I say my role is supposed to represent? And if our wives don't show submission and respect, then what's that going to bring these kids to raise up and how they should treat Jesus Christ as the head of his church? So it's about daily actions that point to something so much bigger than just a relationship between a man and a woman. It's a constant reminder of why we're alive, what our destiny is. To have strong marriages, strong children, strong parents. So important. Something that we as a church have to hold on to and protect because society isn't. It's going as far away from it as it can. And God says you have to protect it because it's special and holy to him, something that he loves. And so we protect it because it mirrors God's greater plan. It's a beautiful thing as we understand it on the deepest level. And it's not always easy, right? As husbands and wives and parents, it can be challenging. And one thing that's a reality too, anything that's valuable and important takes work. Early on, when Whitney and I got married, I forget who it was, but somebody told us, if you want an okay marriage, well then put an okay amount of time into it. So if you want a great marriage, guess what you have to do? Put a great amount of time into it. Right, devote to that person, to build your relationship. Read books on how to become a better husband. And then when kids come along, read books to say, how am I going to become a better father? And get advice and get counseling when you need it. To say, I want this to be great. And so my input is going to be a great amount of work because of the value that I see in this. If you want great families, if you want great relationships, it takes a great amount of time. There's no way around it. That's just the reality of life. This is God's plan, and we have to put the work in to make it as great as he wants it to be. But if we're honest, as we sit in this room, we realize none of us come from ideal family situations in one way or another. Maybe our family wasn't good for whatever the reality, or maybe even currently, we have challenges. Right? Currently, maybe we're single or divorced or any number of other things could be happening. What does that mean for us? That, well, I'm not married, I'm not in this ideal family relationship, so what's my point of being here? And God says he has something equally as valuable for everyone sitting in this room. Go with me to the book of Ephesians, or are you still here in Ephesians? Go back to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19. Ephesians 2, verse 19. Here, as Paul writes, he says, "Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are also able You also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. So Paul starts talking about something slightly different here. He says, you're no longer strangers and foreigners, no matter where you came from, your background, your lineage. He says, you're fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. Right? Isn't that how we kind of identify family here? All we are members of the same household. But here he's saying this analogy of the household, but he takes it not from the physical family unit. But he says you're being built into the family or the household of God. And as much as God values and loves the physical family, equally important, he says, I'm building a family on the earth right now as well. But we're going to talk about his future plan when we're fully born into his family at the resurrection. Right? Full-fledged spirit beings in God's family. But here he says, in a way, you're already becoming a part of that household of God. As he calls us into his family, no matter where you're from, no matter where your lineages were before, so you're being brought together into my house, to be my family, to be my kids. And he says you're being fitted together to grow together to be his holy temple. Not individual temples doing our own thing. So you're being fitted together to be his temple. Each of us to be fitted next to each other to grow, he says, into the holy temple of the Lord. Built together for God to dwell in his temple. We're his temple as we get built together and grow together is what he tells us. So if you don't come from a great physical family situation, that doesn't mean there's no point to all this. He says there's an even greater point of him calling you to his family then, because he gives you the spiritual family that's equally important to what he's doing. And he's calling you into this congregation, into this church, into his body for important reasons and plans. The Father says, come be a part of my household. Come be my family. This desire, this need for strong families isn't just relegated to the physical, but to the spiritual right now is what God says is so important. Go with me just a few pages over to Ephesians 4, verse 15. Here he speaks to this with some slightly different wording, though. There he talks about being a temple fitted together in the household of God. Here he uses another analogy of being a body put together. Ephesians 4:15. He says, by speaking the truth in love, that you may grow up into all things, into him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. So here, instead of using the analogy of a family, he uses the analogy of one body that all of us are being built into. And he uses phrases like joined and knit together. Right, if you're joined and knit to somebody else, it's a pretty close relationship. That's not an acquaintance that you say hi to as you pass each other every Sabbath. Right, that's not really what this analogy of join and knit together into one body speaks to. It speaks to a closeness, an intimacy of this relationship that he says is what the body is supposed to be. He says you're joined and knit together by what every joint supplies to the effect of working by which every part does its share to cause growth of the body. Keeps going back to that every piece, every element is valuable, right? Every joint, every piece, every part does its share so the body can be edified and can grow together. So this is about building a family in the spiritual level. It says, as he calls us into his church, he says, I want you to become a family. Right? It's not just the physical family God cares about. When he calls us, he says, you have to. Part of our calling, a part of the expectation that he gives us, is to become a family, a body that's joined and knit together, working together. And just like the analogy, if you want a great marriage, you put in a great amount of work. But if you want to be a great spiritual family, the same lesson applies. You put in a great amount of work, time, to get to know each other, to spend time with each other, to become a family. Now, growing up, I'm sure you've heard Josh speak, we have a big family. And a lot of us in the church in Cincinnati together for a long time, I don't think I quite ever understood the importance of the spiritual family until we were pulled away from that. About 8.5 years ago, we were sent from Cincinnati to eastern Pennsylvania, about a 9-hour drive from our family. And we quickly realized, well, we're all alone. And we needed family. We had to find ways to develop our spiritual family quickly, because 9 hours is a long time. And so we started building these relationships. And our kids kind of inherited grandparents. There's still a lady in Pennsylvania that our kids call Grandma Rosie. And even though we haven't lived there for over 4 years, she sends our kids birthday cards every year. Because of the relationship that's been developed, because she viewed her kids as her grandkids in a sense, and the family dynamics that are developed. And in California now, where we've been a little over 4 years, the same analogies apply. We found people to be our family in that sense, to say we're a congregation, a family that's joined and knit together. It's not just something we do on the Sabbath, right? Coming to Sabbath services to see each other is kind of the minimum requirement. God says, my vision is that you're a great family, joined and knit together. A household that's doing great things, that's healthy and vibrant, that's doing the work that I've called you to do to fulfill the missions of what he's called his body to be and to do. Now, as God calls us, it's not an individual calling, right? Each of us have to work out our own salvation without a doubt. But it doesn't mean that we can do it by ourselves. He gives us community. He gives us family. He gives us a collective mission to work on together. In Corinthians, Paul speaks of this as well. Go with me to 1 Corinthians 12. We'll begin in verse 12. 1 Corinthians 12, and verse 12. He says, for as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit you are all baptized into one body. Whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, all have been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. Again, he speaks to where we kind of began in Ephesians. Is no matter where you came from, no matter your lineage, no matter your nationality, it says there's one body of Christ. And everyone has different functions, different abilities. We're individuals brought together to be knitted and brought together to do a work together, to fulfill the mission God has given his church, his family. It begins with this analogy of a body, of a family, all these different abilities each of us have. And then he drops down to verse 25, and notice what he says is important about this body. And we skip a section where he talks about, you know, the importance of each member, the foot and the eye and all these parts that each has its function. And in verse 25, he says that there should be no schism, no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. He says the body can't be divided. It can't have schisms, right? There's one church of God. And he says you do all you can to stay together. And he says even another level, it's not even just being together, though. He says there's a desire that if you really care about people, when they suffer, you're going to suffer. You're going to know what's going on in their life when life is hard. You're going to be there to support them and help them. He says, that's what a body does. That's what a family does. He says, and when there's something to celebrate, somebody's honored, he says, you're all there to rejoice together. So that's what a healthy family does. This analogy, what a family looks like, is an image of what a body, the church, is supposed to look like. Just like we get together to celebrate milestones and to be there when life is tough, so that's what the body of believers is supposed to do as well. You're supposed to function as a close-knit family. That's God's expectation for his people as he calls us. And that's hard, right? It's challenging at times, no doubt about it. Because we all have different personalities. But even within my own family, where there's conflict, I won't tell any stories about your pastor while he's not here. That wouldn't be fair. Right? But we've had conflict at times in our life. Right? Overall, our family's very close, so it doesn't mean things are perfect, right? But you find ways to work through it because you believe that our relationship's more important than a conflict, so we're going to work it out. Our relationship, our family is more important than a disagreement, so we're going to figure out how to move past it and have a healthy relationship because we recognize that that's what's most important. And so we make it work even when we have to have hard, uncomfortable conversations because that's what's most important because God's plan is all about the family. And it can be hard and tough, but staying close is more important than some tears and hard conversations. To be joined and knit together, to do what God's called us to do and to be. That's God's expectation for each of us. Let's begin wrapping up here. Go with me to Acts chapter 2 for a moment. Giving a pastor a split sermon is always risky a little bit, but I am wrapping up. Acts 2. We're going to get a quick glimpse of the New Testament church and how they functioned. I'm going to read this because not only is it a reminder to us as a congregation of what the New Testament church looked like, but I think we'll see a quick parallel that that's exactly how a family functions. So Acts 2, you probably know the story a little bit. Day of Pentecost, Peter's giving this powerful message. And what happens? The church grows. 3,000 people, it says, are added to the New Testament church at its creation here on this Pentecost. And as we drop down to Acts 2 in verse 40, it says, "And with many other words, he testified and exhorted them, saying, be saved from this perverse generation. Then those who gladly received his word were baptized, and that day about 3,000 souls were added to them." And notice what it says this new body of believers did. It says, "They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, in fellowship, in the breaking of bread, and in prayers." So it gives us kind of a trademark of what the New Testament church looked like, right? They had a common belief system, the apostles' doctrine. And it says, and they had fellowship. That word fellowship is koinonia. It means a close-knit community. So they were a community that cared about each other. So they had the same beliefs. They became a family. And it says, and they had the breaking of bread. They shared meals. What's a family supposed to do? Right? Have meals together. I think of growing up, we weren't allowed to leave the dinner table until we asked to be excused because we were going to share meals together. Right? Growing up, my parents made a point to say, no, we're going to eat as a family because that's what family does. And so they had doctrine. They had fellowship. They had breaking of bread and said, and they prayed together. They continued steadfastly in this unity. We say, yeah, that's what a congregation's supposed to look like. Isn't that how a healthy family functions? Right? We pray with our kids. We eat meals with our family. We have a set of beliefs or doctrines, rules, right? Our household family rules. And we have community. We have fellowship, koinonia, that we're close-knit together. Right? The church and the family are supposed to function the exact same way. God gave us the family to say, this is what I'm building later on. Also, what you're supposed to be right now, that this is your family. And the more we understand that, the more we hold on to it, the more close-knit we can be and fulfill the calling that God's given us and fulfill his mission that he's given us as well. Now, as we conclude, I just want to go one last verse. Go with me to the book of Luke, chapter 2. Luke 2. You know, as I'm reading and going through Bible study at times, I kind of have a favorite verse for a while. And then I get on a kick somewhere else, and this becomes my favorite verse for a while, right? It's one I keep coming back to. Right now, this is probably my favorite verse. Luke 2. And we'll pick it up in, say, verse 48. So Christ, as a young kid, went to Jerusalem with his family to keep the Passover. Family, parents leave thinking Christ is with them and they're kind of caravan going back home. And at some point they realize, oh no, where's our kid? Right, every parent's worst nightmare, my kid is not here. And so they hightail it back to Jerusalem. And they find Jesus Christ sitting there teaching. And so they're, you know, a little upset, a little scared probably. In verse 48 it says, and when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said to him, son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously. Right? They're a little concerned that they lost their kid. But notice what Christ says to them. And it says, he said to them, why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business? Now, as God's children, isn't that our job? I think Christ gave us a statement that should be kind of our mantra in life. Got to be about my father's business. And one element, what's the father so supposed to be focused on? His family. Right? A father, his first priority is taking care of his family. And here Christ said, about my father's business. But every element of what we do, how we live, how we spend our time, should be with this focus in mind that, am I about my father's business? Am I growing and building and supporting the family that he's building? And so this has kind of become my mantra lately, to be about my father's business. And that business is his family, to take care of it and to grow it as he calls us to do. This is our father's focus, to build his family. And I think it has to be our focus day in and day out. This is our calling, to be about our father's business, of building both our physical families, be representation of what he's doing, and also the spiritual family that he's given to us to be knit and joined together.